All right. Enjoyed the song. Let's turn now to our passage this evening, which is Psalm 4. We'll be looking at tonight's Psalm 4, and the title is Resting in God's Peace. So whereas we looked at Psalm 3 last week, we'll look at Psalm 4. Sometimes they're thought to be companions, and I'll try to point that out to you as to why. But next week, we'll start a study on the life of the beloved disciple Jesus, the life of the beloved disciple of Jesus, John, if I'd say it right. I didn't want to do too much on Sunday morning so we could get moving with the Gospel of John, but I'm going to do a little bit of a study on the author, meaning the Apostle John, starting next week. So I'll have a handout, and we'll kind of do an overview of his life. It'll just sort of supplement a little bit the study, because one thing you'll notice about the Gospel of John as we go through it, John doesn't mention his own name. And so it's a little bit easier to teach it actually outside of the study, which is a little different than normal. But in any event, I'll have that next week with the handout. For the outline for tonight, for Psalm 4, Resting in God's Peace, the first thing we'll do is look at calling to the Lord, verse 1. So this is the outline. So we'll look at calling to the Lord, verse 1. David is going to call out to the Lord. And then in verses 2 through 5, a warning to our enemies. Interesting set of verses there. So we'll look at calling to the Lord, verse 1, a warning to our enemies, verses 2 through 5. And then finally, we'll look at 6 through 8, having joy and peace in the Lord. So the psalm breaks into three parts, calling to the Lord, verse 1, a warning to our enemies, verses 2 through 5. And then having joy and peace in the Lord, verses 6 through 8. So I mentioned last week, and I kind of alluded a little bit, that this is often, this meaning Psalm 4, is often referred to as the companion or a companion to Psalm 3. Now, unlike Psalm 3, though, which we did look at last week, we don't have the superscription. In other words, we don't have... if you remember last week, I mentioned the superscription is the part before verse 1 that says in Psalm 3, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. Most of the psalms of David don't tell us historically the time period, whereas that one does, this one does not. But this one in many cases applies to so many situations in David's life to begin with. And what we'll look at in Psalm 4 is, whereas Psalm 3 is called a morning psalm, morning as in the morning, a.m., this is an evening psalm, and it expresses David's confidence in the Lord despite facing opposition. So David had a lot of opposition throughout his life before and even after he became a king. As I mentioned, this could apply in any case, in many cases, of David's life. But one of the things I'll try to mention to you is it does show us some things that we can do to respond when we have difficult circumstances. Do you ever encounter difficult circumstances? Well, if you don't and you do, then you can do three things the psalm teaches, and there's some others. But the main ones are first to pray, then we have to trust, and then we have to rest in the Lord alone. And that's essentially what David does. Whatever this situation is, it doesn't really matter which one it is, because we don't know, and there's so many you could choose from historically. What it shows is during this difficult circumstance, what David does first is he prays to the Lord. He has total confidence and trust that the Lord will do for him what is good, just, and right, whatever it may be. But then he also rests in the Lord alone. He has peace, and he's able to lay down, as we'll see, and sleep. So that's what we'll look at tonight. Do I have someone who's adventurous who only wants to read one verse? Because the next one will be verses 2 through 5. The whole thing's pretty short. But would someone want to read verse 1 for me, calling to the Lord?
Sure.
Okay.
Answer me when I call and hear my prayer.
All right. Thank you. So we start looking at this Again, the psalm naturally sort of breaks itself up into three or four parts. I just stuck with three, just a little simpler. But the first thing you'll see is that, again, we don't know the circumstance, whereas the last one we do, meaning Psalm 3, where David has the problem with his son Absalom. He's conspired against him. In this case, we just don't know, but I'll deal with that a little bit later. So the first thing is he says, answer when I call. One of the things in the psalm, and you'll see this throughout it, he's not demanding that God do what he wants. In other words, he's not demanding of God to do and have things his own way. He wants to hear from God because he trusts God. He desires that the Lord be gracious to him and just simply hear him. We'll see that as we go through it. But if you look at the verse 1 that was just read, he simply says, answer me when I call. He's not asking him to necessarily answer him in his way. But then he says, you need to be gracious, and he wants him to hear his prayer. One of the things I think that's helpful here, but also will be helpful for us as well, is because David knows the Lord's character, he can trust in him to answer accordingly. In other words, we don't have to go to the Lord and demand him to do certain things. We can appeal to him and we can ask, certainly fine. But David here isn't asking for him to get his own way. But I think one of the reasons is David knows God's character. I think that's one of the reasons we stumble sometimes, is because we don't really know who God is. We kind of have this general conception, and most people, a lot of times, and we use the analogy of God's a judge and he's just getting ready to push his thumb down on us, which just isn't the God of the Bible. It just simply isn't. Judgment is a piece of God, but it's certainly not the totality of him. But in any case, he calls out to God. He wants God to be gracious to him. He just simply wants him to hear, because again, he is assuming that I know what God is like, and since I know what God is like, God will answer accordingly. And you'll actually see this in a minute. And what does he ask for? He wants relief. Whatever this present distress is, he wants relief. Sometimes I actually like that we don't know when these situations are, sort of like the thorn in the flesh. If we knew what was the thorn in the flesh, I know pastoring well enough that people would come and say, nah, it doesn't apply to me because I don't have that same problem Paul had. Sometimes not knowing, in other words, there's sort of this generalized problem, actually is a little bit better. But essentially what he says is he says, I need relief from whatever this present distress is. And so there's this sort of blanket approach. No matter what the distress is, we could pray to God knowing that his character will do right, and he's simply appealing that he gets relief. I'm sure we've all been in distress before and say, God, take the pressure off. And that would be sort of the idea. But notice one of the things he says in there is he says, oh, God of my righteousness. This is really important. David is not appealing to himself. David's not appealing to anything in himself. He's appealing rather to the fact that God, one of the characteristics of God is he's righteous. Do you know that God's righteous too? Is God righteous? Well, if God is righteous, then we know that he will do right. He will judge and bring about things accordingly. He will do justice and righteousness for his people. If we don't know what God is like, I think we're in trouble because we don't really know what to expect from him. Here he's saying God is righteous. And since God, one of his characteristics is righteousness, he can trust him. He knows that God will do right for his people, whatever that end result is. Now you'll also see in this first verse here that whatever this situation is, he wants relief. So he prays to God. He wants him to answer him. Doesn't ask for whatever it is that he wants. He says, since God, you are righteous, you'll do just, you'll do right by me, whatever that is, because you're a just God. I mean, is God going to do something that is inherently wrong? Well, of course not. Goes against his nature. But David also, if you notice, he says, you have relieved me before. What does have mean? It's in the past tense. The point is that he says, in a sense, answer me when I call, do it in accordance with your righteousness, because then it'll be whatever is best. Give me relief from my current distress. And then David appeals to his past experiences with God. You have done in the past, answer me, and you have answered me in an appropriate way, thus I know you will again. I'm going to read you, this comes from the Wycliffe Bible Commentary, and it's just a short, obvious almost statement, but I do think it'll help a little bit. It says, this is the Wycliffe, I said, Bible Commentary says, past experience leads the psalmist, David, to believe that God will again meet his deepest needs. So essentially what that teaches us is that, like David, whenever we have difficult circumstances, it's good to remember how and what the Lord has done for us in the past. Because by doing so, it makes us more confident in the future. In other words, in the present and the future. So if you think, if God has done right by you in the past, maybe it wasn't what you wanted, but whatever it was still ultimately best, it helps us to build confidence in the Lord. This is a psalm where David is confident that the Lord will do right because of who God is, but also because he's seen it in the past. And when you and I need have trouble or distress, we need to go back and look at what God has done in the past. Now, in just a minute, I want someone to read verses 2 through 5. I called it a warning to our enemies. This is really a warning to David's enemies. But so we can understand it a little bit better, that's why I named it that way. But unlike the Lord, David's enemies, they aren't righteous. They aren't seeking righteousness. They're not seeking the good of David. They're actually trying to harm his reputation by spreading lies and slander against David. We know that is true. One of the problems David has experienced is opposition. And sometimes when there's opposition, there's slander or misleading information, which is essentially what's David's problem, whatever the situation is. But David, interestingly enough, warns them that since he is God's chosen, since he is beloved of God, and since God has a purpose for him, it would be wise for them to stop. Because if they don't, they could have negative consequences. So in other words, before we read it, think of it this way. If God has a particular purpose for each of us, and he does, right? And someone is trying to get in the way of it, they probably need to quit, don't they? Because God is not adverse to straighten things out himself. And you would be better to straighten it out rather than letting God straighten it out, is in a sense what he's saying. So let's read verses 2 through 5, and we'll see David's going to rebuke them in a sense, lightly. It's not too strong. He's confident that the Lord will respond, and he's going to urge them to do something to save themselves from God's judgment. But I know that's Gene's name written all over those verses.
Uh-huh. Oh, sons of men, how long be still? Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and trust in the Lord.
Okay, so obviously David has called out to God. He wants relief. He knows that God will do right, not because of David, but because of who God is, his character. When I say God's character, that's another way of saying the attributes of God. If you need to study or don't know the attributes of God, I can guarantee you one thing, they're more than love. Okay, that's pretty much the only one we seem to know. God's God of love, and then we don't know God. But anyway, if you are interested in study of his attributes, let me know. I can give you a few easy things to read. But he appeals to God in because of his past deliverance and help of David. But in these verses here, he's focusing on warning these enemies. So David rebukes these enemies that he has. Again, we don't know who they are. There's no situation that's tied to it specifically. They have opposed David, clearly. They are deceiving. They're making comments about David. They've rejected his leadership. We assume that's what the reference is, meaning as a king. And there's many situations in David's life that fit to this. Now, I'll give you a few suggestions. I don't think we know, and there's no point in trying to figure it out because we don't know. But some people will say, well, since Psalm 3 and Psalm 4 are companions, maybe it's the same situation. Again, we don't know. But why would that matter? Well, because if you remember in Psalm 3, there was conspiracy by his own son, and all of these people were coming up against him. So possible. I just am giving you a couple of other examples just to show you that David's life was not pristine. It wasn't without its problems. So yeah, sure, it could be conspiracy from 2 Samuel 15 through 18. I'm giving you these other two not because I think this is the situation, but just as examples. Do you know David was opposed by his family? 1 Samuel 17:28. He was slandered by Doeg, not dog, Doge. the Edomite, that's 1 Samuel 22, verses 9 through 10. I mention these to you just to give you an idea that we don't know the situation, and the situation of the psalm would apply in any situation, just like it does ours. But in any event, so David rebukes them, but David has confidence in the Lord. If you see in there, this is somewhat repetitious of the first verse, but he says, "The Lord hears when I call." So the Lord here is being seen as someone that David is confident in. The Lord, again, he's using the word there, all capital L-O-R-D. Remember, what is that? What does that mean? Yep, Yahweh. It's the covenant-keeping personal name of God. Whenever it's L and then lower L-O-R-D, that's a different reference. Adonai, for instance, and stuff. But here he says that the Lord Yahweh hears me when I call. And he did, because if you see in verse 3, he says that the Lord has set him apart. David was, as a king, of course, chosen by God, and he had certain things that God was going to work and use through him. God sets you and I apart as well. At conversion, we are set apart for God and his purposes. Turn with me real quick. I will read this one. It's Psalm 31 and verse 23. Sometimes when we hear the word holy, we're thinking holier than thou with some sort of halo over our head. That's not quite the case. I have yet to meet anybody with a halo. Merit gets about as close as they get. But even then, no, I'm just kidding. But in all seriousness, Psalm 31 and verse 23, and I think it's helpful here. O love the Lord, all you his godly ones. The Lord preserves the faithful and fully recompenses the proud. So what we notice in verse 23 is that the Lord, of course, has set apart for himself. He has these individuals that he calls godly people. In the New Testament, it would be the idea of saints. You know, when you read the New Testament, sometimes you have this term saints. When we come to faith in Jesus Christ, we are set apart for God. Okay, and God has particular purposes for us. So God sets people apart for himself. Thus, they are what? They're under his care. They're under his protection, and God cares and protects for his people. It says in that Psalm 31:23, the Lord preserves the faithful. It's the idea, if you ever heard, you never have to worry about dying until you've completed all the Lord's work. It's sort of the idea there. The Lord protects his people, and David is confident in the Psalm that the Lord will protect him. Let me read you this. From William MacDonald in his commentary on this, he says, quote, "Thus who trust in the Lord are as the apple of his eye." That's a reference to Zechariah 2:8. "Their names are engraved on the palms of his hands," Isaiah 49:16. "He hears them when they call and hastens to their assistance." And that's true for you and I. We are his people. He has set us apart. We are saints. We might not always act like it, but we're saints. And then God, of course, he cares for us, and he is always quick to try to help us when we call on him. But back in the psalm here, you'll notice what David does. Well, in verses 2 through 5, of course, he rebukes, he warns, he's confident that the Lord will deliver. But it's kind of interesting what he urges the people who are against him to do, to turn from sin. To do what they're doing, David equates to sin. Is slander sin? Sure. Is oppressing God's purposes and will a sin? Absolutely. So in the verses here, he says in verses 4 and 5, if you're looking back at it, he says, "Tremble and do not sin. Sometimes people equate that to being angry and do not sin. You know, that would be sort of similar to Ephesians, don't let the sun go down in your anger. But in any event, it says they're not to sin. So David urges them to cease from sinning, to trust in the Lord, and to worship him. But let's explain this one piece here. It's in verses 4 and 5. He says, meditate in your heart upon your bed and be still, and then offer sacrifices of righteousness. So David wants him to turn from sin, to trust in the Lord, and to worship him through right sacrifices. What is a right sacrifice? It means to be done in the right spirit. You can do things for God, and he be completely displeased with it. God's wanting more than just simply outward obedience, in other words. The idea here is that God wants us to be right with him and to serve him with a right attitude, a right motives, and those sorts of things. In other words, if you are ornery and doing things for the wrong reason, God, in a sense, is saying, just keep it, because I don't want it. So a right sacrifices means to do things with the right spirit. And you notice, where does all of it originate? Where does worship, where does trust in God, where does service, we might say sacrifice, where does it all originate in? Well, he says meditate on the heart. They need to get their hearts right. The problem with humans isn't external, it's internal. You can't legislate righteousness. You can't cure the human heart with the law. Of course, only God can do that. I'm going to give you two references. I'm going to read one of them. The first one I'm not going to read. Deuteronomy 33:19, and it deals with the heart. This whole idea of heart and sacrifice. Deuteronomy 33:19. There's many references. God is not interested in the people's sacrifices when they are in sin and in disobedience to him and they're doing it for the wrong reason. He, in a sense, says, keep it. Just keep it until you get yourself right. Then go forward and do it. Let's look here at Psalm 51. I'm using this one just because it's an easy one to see. Psalm 51, and I'll read this for time's sake. This is a psalm of David, but this one we know from the superscription after Nathan had confronted him about his, shall we say, transgression with Bathsheba. But down in verses 17 and 19, you can kind of see where I'm going with this. And this is what David is talking about in the other as well. That the Lord wants our hearts first, then service comes. It's not service and then the heart gets right. It's the other way around. The heart needs to be right first. You've probably heard this before. Notice in verse 17, it says, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. A broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. By your favor, do good to Zion, build the walls of Jerusalem. Then you will delight in righteous sacrifices, in burnt offering, in whole burnt offering, and such. So what's the idea there? If you get your hearts right, and you humble yourselves and get your heart right and your spirit right, then you can go make the sacrifices. Until then, keep the sacrifices. Imagine if God told you, keep your service until you get yourself straight. And that would be the idea there. So the heart is what God is always after first. Now, as we go back here, though, David knows, again, he can trust God to bring about things righteously and based off of his character, his past experience, those things. David has rebuked those who are against him, who are lying about him, who are coming and oppressing him, opposing him. He's confident the Lord. He urges them that the only way to fix themselves is if they turn from sin, get their hearts right. But it's interesting the way he ends this in verses 6 through 8 of Psalm 4, because David's peace, his security, his joy isn't based off of the circumstances, but God alone. In other words, when he finishes the psalm, he's going to have peace and joy, and the circumstance won't have changed yet. So something other than the circumstance gives him peace, joy, and then he's able to take a nap, if we will. That's is where the idea of the evening psalm comes in. So I need one more reader. This one's one verse less, but it's verses 6 through 8. Does anybody want to read that? Or else I'll do it.
Make me to dwell in safety.
Okay, so as we look at this, again, pretty simple psalm. He calls to the Lord. He's confident in the Lord and so forth. He tells his enemies who are against him, you need to turn from sin. The way to do that, the way to worship God and all that, will find itself in the heart. In other words, don't go offer sacrifices and keep on with that sin. You need to deal with that. But David's situation isn't going to have changed when he's done penning verse 8 is what I'm getting at. Now, if you see here, it's kind of an interesting one. I'm saying this a little bit of tongue in cheek. Notice how he says many are saying, and then he quotes what they're saying. Who's going to show us anything good? This is, of course, is referring to some sort of opposition, some sort of negative. Probably when David was king, and in a sense, they were saying, we don't like the way things are. Now, what is one problem? It starts with a C that the Israelites have, and of course we don't have a problem with. It's called complaining. The Israelites had the gift, not of gab, but of complaining. They are some of the best complainers were the Israelites, weren't they? Lord, bring us out of Egypt. God does it, doesn't he? Soon as they get out, right down off the exit, what do? Take us back. We don't like the manna. Take us back. I don't know what it is with God's people, but I'm kidding you not. If God gave them an apple, they want an orange. If he gives them an orange, they want to go back to the apple, don't they? They just can't be happy. And the part of the problem is what we just read. Is when their hearts and their spirits aren't right with God, they have sin in their lives, they're going to complain. Okay. There's constructive criticism and then there's complaining, and God is warning in a sense. This is somewhat of almost amusing. But David's response to his enemies is interesting because, quite honestly, I don't know if I would do this often. Notice what David says to him. So he quotes that sort of complaining, whatever that complaining reference is, doesn't really matter. Notice what he says, lift up the light of your countenance upon us. Upon all of those people. So David has a group of people that are complaining about him. And he says, you know what? I'll just ask God to bless them. That seems unbelievable, isn't it? But isn't that what Jesus says? Pray for your enemies, do good for them. If you notice the wording is very similar to the Aaronic benediction. If you don't know what that is, the Lord bless you, keep you, and so forth. The Lord make his face shine upon you. David is asking for God to bless these honorary people that are complaining about him and slandering him. Now, when's the last time you did that? Not too often, but that's sort of the idea. If you don't know the Aaronic benediction, I use it on occasion. It's Numbers 6:24 through 26. So 6:24 through 26 of Numbers. But David knew, in a sense, that all things came and come from the Lord. And that's the one he trusts in. But the psalm ends not on a negative. It ends in a positive. So you have David's joy and peace. David had confidence in the Lord. He knew that the Lord would do right by him and he could dwell in safety. Now, where does this idea of a morning and evening psalm come from? Well, you remember last week, Psalm 3, verse 5, David speaks of lying down, sleeping, and awakening. So he's writing Psalm 3 post-waking. In this psalm, it says, I lie down and sleep because God is the one who will protect me, sustain me, and I have my joy and peace in him. I want to focus on just briefly these two ideas here of joy and peace, because in the New Testament teaches us essentially the same thing. Does joy come from external things? Does joy come when the stock market goes up, when it goes bonkers, or what? Those things are all temporary, aren't they? Notice David's usage. Again, this is poetic language here. Notice he says that God gave him more gladness, where? In his heart than all the grain and new wine that could abound for him. So the idea there is that what he had in the Lord was more important. The Lord gave him more joy than all of those external things. All the things that we see around us today aren't going to last forever. You don't have to look long to see that. And then he also speaks of having true peace only coming from the Lord. Let me look at these two verses and then we'll look to finish up. This is John 14:27. You don't necessarily have to turn here. I'm going to read them real quick. And then just in case someone says, well, wait a minute, surely not in a bad situation. And I'll give you that answer as well. But in John 14:27, Jesus says, peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Do not let your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful. But then invariably somebody gets snarky and says, yeah, but if you were in a really bad situation, like you were in prison, I mean, you couldn't have joy in prison, could you? Philippians 4:7 answers that after saying to be anxious for nothing, but to pray to the Lord, give thanks to him, make known whatever it is that's going on. The result of it is verse 7, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and mind in Christ Jesus. The idea there is that joy doesn't come from things external because they're going to not last forever. You can't depend on them. You can't depend on a car. You can't depend on anything. Peace comes from a relationship with the Lord. Now, David's situation, does it change? No, not here. But what David knows is he can trust the Lord and he can rest in the Lord and have peace because he trusts in his relationship with the Lord. I thought of three things that you could consider from this. They really just come from each of the three sections. First is, in times of distress, remember God's past faithfulness and seek him first in prayer. So in other words, don't go to Twitter. Don't go to Facebook. I know that's a place of authority, I understand today. But we're supposed to pray, but you also need to go to him, because if God's been faithful in the past, he'll be faithful in the future. Second, the Lord wants our hearts right with him before and above all else. I know people sometimes will go and they'll serve and they'll have the worst hearts, the worst motives, and God's in a sense saying the same thing in the Old Testament. Just keep it until you get it straight. Three, true lasting joy and peace will never be found in this world, but only in the Lord. I don't know why Christians still seem to feel like that the world will somehow give them peace and satisfaction, and the Bible reiterates it over and over that that isn't going to happen. So we just need to find that in the Lord, whether it be like David or like Paul. So next week, we will start looking at the beloved disciple, the disciple whom Jesus loved, which is the Apostle John, and we'll kind of give an overview of his life.